Have you got trouble? Wait, don't run. This kind of trouble is lots of fun. Pop-O-Matic pops the dice, pop the six, and you move twice. Race your men around the track and try to send the others back. That's Pop-O-Matic trouble. The game is fun for dad and mother, and sis can trouble her mean old brother. Trouble, trouble, that's the name of Kohner's Pop-O-Matic game. The most exciting chase game that makes trouble fun for everyone. Get Kohner's Pop-O-Matic game. Trouble, that's the name.
He's a demolition demon in a beat-up Chevrolet. It ain't worth a dollar, so he wrecks it every day. Now here is Kenner's SSB smash-up derby set. And you can hoot and holler, cause you ain't seen nothing yet. Crash, bang, crack 'em up, put 'em back again. Crash, bang, smash 'em up, it's smash-up time, my friend. Kenner's SSB smash-up derby set comes with everything you see right here.
You're slugging it out in the middle of the ring. And there's a hard right to the jaw. And Blue Bonnet Black is knocked off.
And Black is knocked off?
Sure, but you can press it right back on again. It's just part of the action with the world's only boxing robots, the Rock'em Sock'em Robots by Marks. Takes two managers to handle the fighters and lots of skill to win. With these control levers, you can keep your fighters in motion to duck punches. When you press this plunger, he throws a right uppercut. Press the other plunger and there's a left jab. Lots of exciting action and fun for everyone when the world's only boxing robots battle it out.
The Blue Bomber's looking for an opening. And there it is. That's the end of round two.
Just push the flying head back and you're ready for round three.
Boy, this is a great...
You bet! The world's only boxing robots! Get the Rock'em Sock'em Robots by Mark!
Meow?
Meow?
Can I talk to Chris, please?
Meow?
I don't Hello? Understand. Oh, hey. I see you had somebody else answer.
Yeah, somebody was borrowing my headsets.
Yeah. It's a good picture.
He was using it to do his Ask for Breakfast podcast.
Oh. Nice.
That's about the only time that he makes a lot of noise.
When he wants his breakfast?
Yeah.
He's quiet otherwise? Even when he wants it, does he ever want attention?
He just kind of fights his way into your lap. He makes most of his noise before and after he eats. Before, because he thinks that we're going to somehow forget about him. And then afterwards, we call it his celebration. He'll walk around the house and go, "Rawr!
Rawr!"
And the only reason we can figure it out is he's just celebrating that he just ate.
It's a celebration dance.
Yeah.
I usually do that with a nap.
Yeah. That's your having eaten celebration?
Yeah, only if I eat too much.
Mm. Yeah.
Puts me to sleep. You didn't like my picture of my food yesterday, man. That was delicious.
I just wasn't sure what it was. I could tell there was a burger under there somewhere, but I couldn't tell what was happening on top of it.
Chorizo and carne adobada. Mmm.
Chorizo is a good flavor.
Yeah, it was good. And chili cheese fries, Christmas style.
There we go. I was trying to figure out why you were so quiet, even though I was turning up the volume, but I had to go into the volume in Skype itself.
Oh. Anyways. Quiet now? I mean, am I coming across clear?
Yeah, I don't think it was on your end.
It's probably your cat. Probably turned the volume low.
Yeah, he probably was messing with it. Messing with my settings.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to yell at him like Bill and his kids.
Get off the internet.
Yeah.
Dusty, stop playing Minecraft.
You could have half of a donut. Only half of a mini donut.
Yes, you can have 1/4 of a treat.
Yes. I was just reading Star Wars.
What is your name?
What is my name?
Mm-hmm.
My name is Michael Myers.
Then my name will be Mike Myers too.
There you go. I'm talking to myself on a parallel earth.
You have no idea what I'm talking. Did you watch Buck Rogers?
I do know what you're talking about. You're that woman.
Okay. Yes.
You set me up. And I didn't swing. Yeah. I watched the ball go right past me.
You're caught looking.
I got caught looking at that strike. Whoosh. No, yes, you're not Mike Myers. I will name you Chris Ivy. See how I did that?
Yes, there you go. My name is Chris Ivy.
There you go.
So, yes, we have a new Buck Rogers to talk about today, and we're getting there. We're getting close to the end. I think we have maybe 5 or 6 more.
There's only one disc left. I know that.
Yeah.
At least my set.
Mine too. Yeah, this finished
up. This was disc 4. Finished the last episode.
Mm-hmm. And
what a waste of Twiggy.
We do have
That's what I say. God dang, what a waste. You got Mel Blanc back. And you have him have 4 sentences. What's up with that?
That was 4 more than a lot of the episodes this season, though.
I know, but it's like they could have sent him down with Buck. Like he didn't play any different a role, even though his voice was back.
Yeah, he had a few more lines, and it looks like they tried to write him a little bit more humorously.
It still had more Crichton, though. Still a lot more Crichton.
Yeah. Yeah. But they tried to establish a more direct relationship between the two robots. It looks like that's how they're going to use him as companion to Crichton more. But it was a step in the right direction. Just wasn't. It's not a full reversion to how Twiggy used to be in the show, which that definitely fits more of the tone of the first season than it does this tone of this season, where even with this episode, they're still going for a more serious Star Trek type of episode.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's still kind of akin to the other episodes this season, but I feel like it was one of the stronger episodes of the season.
I liked the plot. But I didn't like the episode that much.
Because of the acting, or?
No, I just couldn't get into it that much. It was kind of very simple. I mean, they were losing power on the ship. They had to go down to this planet and try to mine some of those crystals so they could start traveling again. They were drifting for a while, and they had the stabilizers on, which allowed them to stabilize themselves above this planet so they could find these crystals. And they get there and they find crystals, which is all good, and they find this like mummy looking thing.
Yeah.
And that's where the plot thickens, where the mummy is, you think it's a monster, but they put it aboard the ship along with the crystals, and then that mummy escapes. And then you see a girl, a young girl, attractive girl, wearing this like Greek toga on the planet, and she's just like mind wiped. You don't know why. Right. She just doesn't know anything. Hence how we opened up the show where she would say, "Hi, I'm Buck Rogers." Because he said that. She didn't know what to say, so she said the same thing. And then he did give her two names to pick from. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what they were. Do you?
I can't remember the one she didn't choose, but the one she chose was Laura.
Yeah.
So that's what they call her throughout the episode, is Laura. And, it's Buck, Hawk, and Wilma. They're on a shuttle. And the planet's name was Philoctetes. And the interesting thing, they think it's a mummy because it looks like a humanoid that's wrapped in something, but it's not wrapped in cloth like an Egyptian mummy. It has a sort of outer skin that looks almost like bark.
Yeah, he looked like a tree.
Yeah.
Kind of like a really bad Groot.
Yeah. And he appears to be super strong because they actually leave him in a closed room in the shuttle. And when they get back and it's escaped, it's ripped open the door in the process. It seems that the whole thing with the like I said before, with Twiggy, is that they're going to kind of set him up as Crichton's companion, or as they sort of joke around that he's technically Crichton's father, in this, at least that's what he's calling himself, because he's been around longer than Crichton. Wilma, because she's in the field, she has more of her uniform is more similar to the ones that she wore in the first season a lot, and I did think that they gave her more to do this time. She showed more expertise running a lot of the various equipment that they use throughout the episode.
Mm-hmm.
She takes a blood sample from Laura, and they get a sample of the mummy's blood off of the door because it injured itself escaping the shuttle, and she runs a comparison on the two, and she thinks something's wrong with the equipment because the sample comes back that the mummy and Laura have a similar blood sample. And while this is going on, it's in this makeshift tent that they set up, and we see that Laura's actually listening outside of the tent, and she gets upset with the idea that she has something in common with Laura, or with the monster. And right after that night, the mummy attacks the camp and takes a bucket of the crystals that they've mined, and he tries to take Laura with him too, but they stop him from taking Laura, but he gets away with the crystals, and they're not really sure what the deal is, why the mummy is after the crystals.
That was a cool part. I like the overall plot because you find out that the crystals evolve them. And the cool part of the plot is they thought it was inverse, kind of like the Golden Boy. It's very similar. Like it had like a small twist.
Crichton actually messes up.
Yeah, you originally think that the human-looking person is going to turn into this bark creature, right, and it's inverse.
Yeah, that's what initially Crichton comes out onto the bridge and says, "Now hear this. I have an important announcement to make." And he tells them that they have a sort of what he calls catagenesis, that they degenerate, that they start out as human-looking, and then over time they develop more and more of that bark over top of themselves. But then they end up using this mind visualizer machine they put on Laura, and Wilma operates this too, where they put it on there, and then they have a screen that can show what she's thinking about, and they ask her to visualize meeting them, and she's particularly focused on Buck. You know, she seems to have kind of a crush on Buck. But when they ask her to remember 3 days prior to them arriving, they just sort of see this swirling green blur on the screen. They ask, assuming that she's grown up, Wilma asks her a bunch of questions, like, where did you go to school, and do you remember any friends, or maybe a sister, or... And they just see this, continue to see this green blur on the screen. But then when they ask her, can you visualize your mother? Or, and she doesn't know what a mother is. And they describe, well, it's where you came from. And she sees sort of a half, it doesn't come in clear all the way, but she sees a, whether it's the mummy that's been attacking, but or one that looks like it. And so they're all kind of surprised that she has some kind of connection. She continues to act weird. There's a moment where she seems really transfixed by the crystals and goes into a trance and almost attacks one of the men that are in the field with them. And then that's when Crichton shows up on the bridge and is hesitant to tell everyone that he actually made a mistake.
I think Buck wanted to get it on with her, though. Like, he was attracted to her, and then when he found out she was gonna turn into some bark, he was like, oh no.
Yeah, it was hard to say. I mean, this
he almost had like a mentor ability for her, but it seemed like she was sexually attracted to him, and then he became that.
It kind of skirted the line. It wasn't Buck in this season. I mean, he hasn't really had many opportunities because there hasn't been many attractive female guest stars, and this is one of the first times this season. Laura is actually played by Amanda Wiss, who I knew from Nightmare on Elm Street and Fast Times. She's in the very first Nightmare on Elm Street.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
Yeah, she plays Judge Reinhold's girlfriend.
Oh, I don't remember her. I remember Phoebe Cates and the other girl that got knocked up.
Yeah.
By the ticket scalper guy. Mm. I didn't remember that Reinhold had a girlfriend. I just remember him listening to the cars in the bathroom. Do, do, right. Do, 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 do.
I mean, the main thing, I think one of the biggest roles, or where she really became known for the first time, was from Nightmare on Elm Street. I think she's the one that gets killed where her blood is spread all over the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
The bedroom, but she's a pretty big supporting role. She's friends with the main girl in the first Nightmare on Elm Street. But anyways, she...
The one with the streak in her hair?
Yeah, that ends up with it when she's frightened, yeah.
And I haven't seen that movie in years.
It's been a long time. 6 or 7 years ago, I watched a lot of the Nightmare movies over again. But,
or maybe, I think I watched all of them almost.
But anyways, this is a spot where Twiggy gets a few lines. He says, I just can't believe he's my son. What's the matter, Crichton? Cat got your annunciator circuit? That's probably the most he says. But so yeah, Crichton explains he got the images backwards. They actually start out as a mummy, and they have this weird... He assumed that they were originally from Earth, but they're actually from some other planet. And they arrived on this planet and created a colony, and they have this weird genetic process where they're fabricated from full-size DNA, and then they did away with pregnancy and childhood, and the light from the crystals that we had been talking about, those are the ones that activate them and make them into a more human-looking person. And so Laura, she's already actually gone through all this process, and what they've been calling the mummy is another one of her people that hasn't completed the process. And Buck helps that process along because him and the mummy get in a fight. And in the process of the fight, I guess the man is pretty close to time for transformation because the pressure of Buck fighting him starts to pull off the bark. Basically, he rips the costume off of the guy. But, and it turns out to be a dude that I don't know if they come out of the bark wearing the
togas,
sort of toga like garments, or if they have some on supply nearby, but he's wearing one similar to her at the end. And as time goes on, their memory is coming back. I don't know if having her companion back or out of the bark is triggering her memory, but she seems to be remembering things. She says, "My name was not meant to be Laura, but I'll keep using that name in remembrance to remember Buck." But she's going to stay on the planet. And there's a little joking moment at the end where Wilma teases him and asks him, you know, if he feels bad that he got chosen for, or that she chose the other guy or whatever. And he says, you know, I guess you'll just be stuck with me. And she says, she does an imitation of Laura, because the whole time she acts sort of childlike and innocent. And so Wilma says, "Oh, Buck Rogers, does that mean we will be together for always?"
That was a good flashback into the first season, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have that, like, wittiness with each other anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least the last two episodes ended in a joke. Mm-hmm. Or kind of like everybody laughing.
Right. Yeah, it's just more of they used to always in the first season do stuff that had to do with the disconnect between Buck and the 25th century.
Yeah.
And
I do miss the campiness, though. I think the plots are fine and the characters are fine, and it's not what the show started off to do. It's like let's be a Star Trek now.
Right. You know?
Let's explore strange new worlds and mm-hmm. new stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like Buck Rogers in the 25th century. They don't use like his, except for that episode we didn't like, they don't use like his legacy anymore that he's from the 25th century. He's just like you wouldn't even know in some of these episodes.
No, and I think if the show continued to go on and on, even if they kept a feel of the first season, it would make sense that he'd become more acclimated, but they didn't really show that process. They just, all of a sudden, it's like they flipped a switch and he's acclimated, and they're not really paying much attention to the fact that he's actually from the past and he's playing a more Captain Kirk role. He's they even call him Captain, and he's in control, and he does the fist fights, which that's not different, but
you know what is very different is Wilma, I thought, was a way stronger character in the first season, and now she seems like she's like an Uhura, you know, like a side character going down the planet. Or
you've said that. I don't again, just like with Twiggy, where this episode wasn't, you know, a complete reversal, it did move more in the direction. I think that this episode moved her more in the direction of, it's not completely a return to how she was in the first season, but I do think, because we had a lot of episodes this season so far where she does hardly anything other than sit on the bridge, like you said, like Uhura over by her equipment and makes a comment once in a while when she's asked for information, where, you know, this episode she was at least a part of.
She at least got to be beamed down.
Yeah, and she, instead of just operating random equipment, you know, she was doing some specific field tests, and I think, and like I said, her uniform was more like the ones that she wore in the first season and stuff, and it seemed to move in the right direction, just not a full change.
Yeah.
But it was cool to have Amanda Wiss on the show. To finally have an interesting guest star for the first time in a while. Also, the main guy that Asimov talks to on the bridge about stuff, he was played by Alex Hyde-White. And people might know him from... He played the young Henry Jones in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. So he played like the young version of...
His name sounds familiar. Like,
yeah, he's been in a lot of stuff.
Did he play something else?
He's been in another thing. He also was the guy that played Reed Richards in that really bad Fantastic Four.
Oh, that's what I know him from. Yeah. Roger Corman.
Yeah, but he was Reed Richards in that. And he's been in... Those are the two sort of... geek fandom sort of things that he's connected to, but he's been in a lot of TV and
the toy. He was in the toy. That was a big movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what he was in that. Pretty Woman.
Yeah, Pretty Woman's another one that he's known for, I think.
Catch Me If You Can. That was a good movie.
So I like the episode. I thought it was pretty good.
Who am I thinking of? The guy who shot John Lennon. Do you remember his name? Chapman?
Right.
Something Chapman? Who shot John Lennon? Somebody Chapman. I can't think of his first name. But anyway, that guy was in the Swamp Thing TV show. That's who I was thinking of.
Oh, really? It was Mark David Chapman.
Yeah, I remember the actor's name was in that, and every time I would see him in the Swamp Thing TV show, I would say, God, that's the guy who killed John Lennon. He's on Swamp Thing now.
I always have to think for a minute because all of those, it's weird how all of those assassins have three names. They always have their middle name. Like, John Wilkes Booth and Lee Harvey Oswald. It's weird.
And that's why I thought of this guy, because his Alex Hyde White. Even though it's like Hyde White with a dash in it.
Yeah, it's not a middle name.
It's the three names. So as soon as they had, I was like, hey, that guy was in Swamp Thing. But no, I was way off.
Like, yeah, we need to be careful if we meet anybody that's got three names.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if we know anybody, we gotta be careful. So that was pretty good, I thought. And we've got, let's see how many episodes we got left.
Five.
I think it's five, right? Yeah. So five more episodes. Sometime in the meantime, in the next couple of months, I have to start thinking about
what else to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a while since we've had to make that decision.
The first thing we did was the Kirby omnibuses, and now we did the Buck Rogers, and who knows?
Yeah, we had a break while we were doing Fourth World.
I'll actually let you pick this time, because I picked the last two are kind of guided us in that direction.
Kind of. But it wasn't as if I had no say in it.
Oh, yeah. You could have said, fuck Buck Rogers.
Yeah.
I don't have any interest in it.
And you'll obviously have some say, even if it comes from my suggestions.
Yeah.
Know, because it's a long commitment, you know.
It is.
And we can always do a couple one-offs before we start another big project or something. We don't have to jump right into one, but it's been good. We got five more, and we had a break at one point with where we did the Flash issues. So, but it has been kind of neat doing something that's not comics.
Yeah, yeah.
I like doing the movies and the TV.
It is a good mix.
Makes it a mix, so it's not just a comic book show.
Yeah.
But
we already do talk the comics, so.
Yeah. Well, I know I have a few listener questions from an email that Brian Reigate sent us. I don't know if there was anything other than those.
No, I didn't. I was lazy this week.
Okay. Do you want to do those real quick?
Then? Sure.
All right, I got it up here. First one, there's two of them that he sent in an email to us. First one is, what current books or books that are shy of your 10-year rule are you really looking forward to talking about on retros in the future? So really, anything at this point would be post 2005 that you're looking forward to cover. Now, I gotta say, I don't really have a direct answer to the question, but it did make me curious to look as to where comics were at 10 years ago. And I have to say, I was kind of surprised a lot of stuff that came out 10 years ago, I didn't realize it had been 10 years. To give a picture kind of where things were at, you had, I won't mention a lot, but just a few things that were coming out this month in May of 2005. You had Action Comics 827, Amazing Spider-Man 520, Joss Whedon's Astonishing X-Men was on number 11. You had Batman Gotham Knights was on issue 65. I mentioned that because that's probably one of the closest things that you've come to as far as close to the deadline.
Oh man, I'm barely cradling the, the criteria there.
Yeah.
I do run across as I'm looking through boxes and say, I want to talk about this, but I can't.
Do you remember what any of those are? Or?
Well, I'd like to do Final Crisis again. I'd like to revisit that at some point. And yeah. I know for a fact I want to do Identity Crisis, which is my favorite of all time. Mm. I'd like to revisit that.
That would be interesting for us to cover together because when I read it, because it's one of your favorite of all time, and I'm interested to see if I could open up my mind to it or have a different experience reading it because I didn't like it. So that might be interesting, or it could be the end of the podcast. I don't know.
Yeah, be the breakup.
It could be the breakup.
Actually, that is 10 years old now.
Oh
no, it's not. Is it? 2004. It is 10 years. We could cover that.
So we could cover it after Buck Rogers.
Actually, though, I like the idea of trying to keep it. I mean, we could do it on top of whatever we're going to do, but I like to be able to do something different, like you said, like TV or movies.
Yeah. Well,
like,
we could.
I have ideas, but I'd like you to do the next one. Like, I really want to revisit Battlestar Galactica, the complete series. I really do. And the other one I want to do is revisit the Hulk. But that one is too much of a commitment. That would take us into like.
That's a big commitment.
Wonder or a Man from Atlantis. Too. Like, there's a lot of them. Even Logan's Run, the TV series. These are out of your purview because you're younger than me.
Right.
So they'll mean something very, very different to you than they did to me.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of how we got started with Buck Rogers too, at least the first seasons. There's a lot of stuff that you grew up with that I haven't watched that are still well known. Sci-fi stuff, you know, well-known geeky stuff.
I'm up for this identity crisis, though, if you want to do like one issue, because it's only 7 issues.
Yeah, we could always do...
We could always do like one, and then 2 weeks late, you know, after the every other week do another episode or something.
Yeah, or we could... Or they just do it over the course of 2 episodes, you know, do the first 3 or 4 issues and then do the remainder the next time or something.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, we'll talk some more about it.
Yeah.
In the meantime, interestingly, this month, 10 years ago, was the first issue of the Geoff Johns Green Lantern. That's when that came out.
Yeah.
JSA
is something I'd like to revisit too. I don't know if you would like to revisit that, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, Jeff plan Johns, on rereading JSA. That at some point. That was so on good. Issue. That was actually pretty close to being done. I mean, it's actually on issue 73 already, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What else is going on? We were rolling into Infinite Crisis. They were on some of the lead-in titles were starting to roll out. And they had
that
cross...
That's another one I'd like to revisit. There's a lot of like Batman miniseries that are after that. After...
Mm-hmm.
They're like 2005, 2006. I'd like to personally do them because I see them in the long box when I go through the Gotham Knights and I was like, I want to read this. Oh, maybe I'll wait. Next year. Catch it next time.
Yeah. 7 Soldiers is going on.
That would be interesting to revisit in order. Mm-hmm. I read that as it was coming out.
Yeah. Why the Last Man was on issue 33 and Walking Dead was on issue 20. So yeah, when I looked at this, I was surprised to see a lot of stuff that I didn't think was 10 years old. And I don't know, at some point it could be kind of interesting for me to pick a series and kind of read it as it came out.
Yeah.
you know, so it would kind of be, if it was a monthly book, it would be roughly every other episode I would talk about it, but I don't know, maybe I'll keep an eye on as we go along each month if new series pop up or something. I mean, I could do that with Green Lantern. I don't know if I wanna, I didn't read that all along, but I did read it when it was first coming out because I was his Flash run was still going on and I was into it by then. Flash 222 came out 10 years ago this month, and so I didn't have any history with Hal Jordan, but because I was reading that, I was reading Flash and JSA and really liking John's writing at that time, so I jumped on Green Lantern from the beginning and read it for about a year or so, but I didn't follow it all the way through. So anyways, I thought that was kind of interesting to look at.
Yeah.
Did you have anything else you wanted to say on that question? Or
no, because that one I go through every week and I can't remember from week to week. Like I was like, oh, I can't cover this.
Yeah. All right. So his other question was: are there any retro comics characters or toys that you're surprised have not been brought back for a new generation? And he gave 2 examples for himself. He's surprised that they haven't brought back Silverhawks or the Visionaries. And Silverhawks sounded familiar to me, and I had to look it up, and that was actually from same team as Thunderhawks.
Yeah, I kind of know what they look like. But yeah. I'm not familiar with them. You guys, he's younger than is he roughly your age?
I think so.
Because he talks about Transformers and stuff.
I get that impression. Yeah.
Yeah, I get that he's roughly your age.
Yeah, Silverhawks. I watched Thundercats more than I did Silverhawks, but that's a good call for him considering Thundercats was brought back, and apparently in the Thundercats remake from a few years ago, one of the characters from Silverhawk had a brief cameo. I'm just noting that from the Wikipedia page. So that was a Rankin Bass show. And then Visionaries, I don't remember, but it's interesting because it was a Sunbow Productions, just like Transformers and G.I. Joe, but only had one season of 13 episodes. And it had a subtitle, The Spectral Knights, or The Knights of the Magic Light. I don't remember this at all, but I remember, obviously, a lot of the other shows that Sunbow did. And there was even, like, a lot of the Hasbro properties and stuff. There was some comic books under Marvel Star Comics line.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff, but I don't remember any of those. So for me, I mean, going off of this, I didn't have a lot, but I was able to kind of go off of his, and I found one that I did remember that was another Sunbow. It's kind of similar to Visionaries that I do remember, that it was called Inhumanoids. And again, it was only one season, 13 episodes. It was about a group called the Earth Corps, and they actually battled the Inhumanoids. And they had other beings that helped them and stuff. And it was, like I said, it wasn't around very long, but I do remember seeing it on television, and they could do something with it. Again, there was Marvel Comics under the Star line. There was only four issues, and I guess I'm not totally off base on this, because apparently there were some rumors around 2009, 2010 that Kevin Smith was writing a reboot for the comic book. Nothing ever came from it, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, looks like someone has thought about it, though. And that was the only thing I came up with, though.
For me, I'm going to go back to 1972 and 76. There was no cartoon or anything based on this, but it was a toy line. I would love to read a miniseries on Big Jim's pack.
I knew you were going to say that.
Big Jim, Dr. Steel, Warpath, the Whip, and Torpedo Fist. I'd be happy.
You love Jim's pack.
I do. They were way ahead of their time, man.
Somebody get Mike Jim's package. I mean,
yeah, the laser vet and the camper with the motorbike. I love that shit, man. If they would just release that, I'd be happy. I'd also like to see Rom again, Space Knight.
Yeah.
He was a toy. He never had it. I don't think he had an animated series, but...
No, but he definitely had a comic.
I didn't watch... When all this stuff was coming out, I was falling out of animation.
You mean the stuff I'm talking about? The 80s stuff?
Yeah. I was... Like right now, I like reading G.I. Joe a lot. But I never was on it during the Marvel run. Do you know what I mean? I was never on it during the animated series. I like reading IDW's G.I. Joe and even the retro one, A Real American Hero. I love reading that thing.
Right.
But I was very late to the party. And then also Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Never read them.
Mm-hmm.
And just watched the movies that came out. That's something I'd like to watch again, to tell you the truth.
No, I you mean the original movies?
The original movies, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing the first couple again.
Yeah.
No, I know exactly what you mean, because just it's for me, it's people that are in their 20s, you know, people that, because I went through that same stage, I think, where you get to be an older teenager, or you're in college and you don't really have a lot of time, and we end up reconnecting with a lot of this stuff once we're out of school, and and we have some more time again in the evenings or whatever after work and stuff, you get reconnected to it. But, you know, there's kids. I'm calling them kids. But, I mean, there's guys that...
Get off of my lawn.
Exactly. But there's younger guys and girls in their 20s.
Oh, I think I just lost you, Chris. God damn it. Did we lose the internet?
Oh, no.
Okay, I thought we lost the internet.
I did a Bill Bummer. I smacked the...
mute button?
Mm-hmm.
I was like looking at my internet light and it was flashing like it was working. I was like, what the hell's going on?
No, sorry. I hit it with my hand. What kind
of mic do you guys have that you hit? Like, this is something that never happens to me.
Mine's actually in the cord. So,
but isn't it a switch? Or is it a button?
It's a button.
Okay. That's a problem. The ones that I had in the cord were switches. You'd have to switch it off.
No, I have a...
I have a wireless headset now, so I can move around, and I have to actually touch the ear to go mute.
Yeah, when we first started the show, I had a desktop computer I was recording on, and I had headsets that were... a regular headphone jack, but I had a good sound card, so the quality came out okay. And then when I switched to my laptop that I have now, I ended up getting this different headset because the sound card interaction with the old headset didn't sound very good. And this is a Microsoft Life Chat.
Ah.
It's not... at the time, I just needed to get something quick that was a USB mic, and then get something quick turned into... I'm still using it a long time later, but I was actually, when I sat down today, I was futzing around with the cord, and it was... I had my iPhone plugged in to the computer also, and the cord to the computer, and they were all connected, and I was... and so it made me think, man, it made me think of your headless mic and wireless mic, and how I might be time to get a different one.
Did I say headless?
No, I did.
Okay. Like the headless horseman.
Exactly. The headless podcaster. So anyway, what I was trying to say before I muted myself was just that people, fans, geeks and stuff in their early 20s, sometimes they'll talk with nostalgia about stuff like Pokemon and things like that there were in the late 90s, early 2000s that I just have no connection with. I have no nostalgia. I mean, even sometimes Micah, you know, on Geek Brunch, he'd talk about things that I just don't have any nostalgia for. Because I have that gap. It's just my gap is later than yours, you know?
Yeah.
So I know what you're talking about.
The one thing that I can't get into is like the Transformers. I'll watch the movies just fine, but I try to get into the comic books and the toys and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that's ever got me close is Tom Scholey drawing them. Mm-hmm. And you know how I like them so much.
Yeah. I'm not into Transformers either. When I was a kid, I had a few of the toys and I liked them okay. But I still want a Devastator because
of the Constructicon. Mm-hmm. The Constructicon is awesome because this goes back a long way, but I used to play with Tonka trucks. You probably never even heard of these things.
Yeah, I've heard of Tonka trucks.
I don't even know if they still exist, but they
I don't
were
know
like
if they do now. But
they were like these metal trucks, and,
yeah,
and they were like I'd have like a Tonka crane, a Tonka fire engine, a Tonka, all these different tractors. Now I think they have like John Deere brand toys. Probably. Yeah,
and they're probably light plastic because Tonka trucks were heavy as hell.
Oh, they were heavy. I mean, they were really heavy. They were sturdy as heck. I mean, you could carry rocks in them. I mean, boulders. But that I like that Transformer for that reason, that it's all these like truck, you know, like construction vehicles.
Yeah, the
Constructicons. Yeah, Tonka.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they phased them out.
They may have after the fact, you know, after the 80s and stuff. But when I was a kid, toys were still not as safe as they are today.
Yeah, and Tyco would have the racetracks that I would use a lot. I would love those things. And the trains.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the rest of that question? Is that what that question? Is there any other part of it or?
No. It's just if there was any that we were surprised haven't been brought back, and
Yeah, mine are kind of lame because they never were comics, so I'm kind of inventing my own.
Well,
I think Big Jim might have had a comic, but it was like part of the toy.
Yeah, and the question was that it could be a comic property that hasn't been brought back, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. Yeah. Didn't necessarily have to have a comic. It could be any sort of IP or property, geek property that was around back in the day that hasn't been revived, when we have had so many that have been.
Right, like Mego dolls. They've been revived.
Mm-hmm.
The Mego. I like the Migos a lot.
And I think that, I don't know, I feel like that's something that you have to have nostalgia for.
I'd buy a comic book about Tonka trucks.
I think I'd have to skip that one. I'd have to hear a lot of good reviews before I ordered that one. I wouldn't be pre-ordering that one, no matter how many memories I had of them. But
well, thanks, Brian, for the questions. I was just listening to his Robin episode. I'm a little bit behind.
Yeah, that was good. I just listened to the most recent one yesterday while I was cleaning. On another Hawkman
episode.
That was really good. Comics and History. Check it out. I did a... I don't know if you saw that he made a comment in response, but at the end of my last From Kid to the Flash episode, I did a tribute to the way that he ends his show.
Oh, yeah.
So I did the whole...
Until
next time, until more Teen Titans, until, you know, this and that. And I said, class is dismissed. And then while I was saying it, I had the Canadian national anthem start playing behind my voice. And the end of the episode was the Canadian national anthem.
Yeah.
Which I meant it as a tribute, you know.
Yeah. So. You weren't stealing his iconic ending.
Yeah, but the funny thing was that he has a 45, whatever he uses to record it, has a 45-minute limit, I think.
Yeah.
And so he was rushing at the end of the latest episode, and it cuts out before he says, class is dismissed.
Ah.
So then I was laughing like I stole it from him. Me using it, stole it out of his own podcast.
I don't know what we would do on some certain podcasts with 45 minutes. It's like we just get started in 45 minutes.
Yeah. You're especially DC Noise.
Yeah. I got to get that out, man. That's the only one that I have to edit because it's one big 5-6 hour podcast I have to break up into. And usually I don't give a crap. And somebody says, why did the ending? I get these emails. Why did the ending end so abrupt? It's because I just pick a random spot. I cut it out and then mark the time and then continue later. I'm a lazy podcaster.
Those listeners just don't know how you do it yet. Tell them it's a cliffhanger.
It's a cliffhanger. It's
supposed to whet your appetite.
Except I don't go until you hear Keith Knudsen talk about his gas. Until Daryl passes sometime. Out and starts snoring.
Yeah. Sometime you'll have to add a little one on there.
Until Keith drinks out of his booby glass.
Oh, they'll be waiting a long time.
Long for that.
Michelle will have to go on vacation by herself.
I don't think that the glass is like even in the house anymore.
No, I don't think so.
That's my theory.
It's in a trash compactor somewhere in Virginia.
Or he gave it to one of his coworkers.
Yeah.
I don't think it exists in his house. I don't know. And then he doesn't want to drink out of the urinal, the one that Daryl gave him. So he doesn't want to drink out of either one. Daryl wants to see him so bad drink out of either glass. Poor guy.
I know. That's sad. He's going to have to...
It's a damn shame.
Yeah, exactly. Daryl's going to have to do... he's going to have to hold on to that for a long time.
Yeah.
So...
You want to jump into comics?
Sure.
All right. I got one. I'll talk about a comic that came out in 1994 of July, and it was from DC Comics. I've been picking on DC a lot lately. Thank God you do the Marvel.
The funny thing is though, I thought to myself, I haven't done any DC Comics in a while, so I did DC this time.
I chose... This series I didn't read when it was coming out, but I read the first three later, and I got the rest of the series, but it's Damage number 4. And if you remember, Damage played a huge part in Zero Hour because he kind of like blew things up and brought everything back. He also was the descendant of Al Pratt. So he was a Titan. He was on various groups. But this was his own series they launched, and it was launched by Tom Joyner. And if you go to his wiki page, it says Tom Joyner, PhD. So I guess he's a PhD. I wonder what he's a PhD of. Let's see. PhD in theater. And he's from the University of Boulder, Colorado, so he's in my neck of the woods. I don't know if he's still there. But he's in, like, acting and stuff. He's got credited, like, some Batman Legends of the Dark Knight. Damage, he did the whole series. Deathstroke, towards the tail end. Dr. Fate, he has one issue. A series called Hammerlock, which I've never read. Scarlet, which I don't remember reading, but I know I think I have it. And a couple of Who's Who's and one-shots. So he doesn't have a lot of work, but he did do all of Damage. And this series was not a good jumping on point. I mean, this issue number 4, because it opens up with one of his villains is in the hospital, and he's watching him fight. Damage is fighting the troll, and I guess like when he's kind of like the spoilers, but in the new Superman power, he could release all his power in the form of like energy. And then he's a regular human. Well, that's kind of like Damage. Once he doesn't charge up, he's kind of like a human character. And he's fighting this like Hulk-like character called the Troll, who actually does look like the Hulk. Like if you were just to look at him, he looks like the Hulk. And he's fighting him with a broken arm and no power, and he's kind of trying to survive. And then a bunch of other characters from a secret organization like Wildheart comes into play. And she tries to attack the troll. And there's these two brothers who have mechanical parts that work for their mother that are going after Damage. And then the other cool thing about this is they have a little side story arc that ties together at the end with Iron Monroe. And he was a big part in Manhunters and in the Young All-Stars. I think it was called the Young All-Star comic. And... I think he's a Golden Age type character. And so he looks very different in this, though. He looks like a yuppie he's very 90s looking. And it ends up with him defeating the troll and him teaming up with Iron Monroe. And it's like a cliffhanger at the end where he finds a secret organization that they're going to fight. They actually beat they beat the troll with a drug called Stardust. They got him so high that he passed out. But it has some interesting I started like a pop culture group on Facebook, you know, trying to capture pop culture items in here, you know, like references to things that were happening in the time. And there was like a LaToya Jackson thing, and whoop, there it is. He actually punches Damage and says, whoop, there it is.
Nice.
So I like to like look at those pop culture references, you know, because it gives you a time frame of what was going on.
Right. Yeah, actually, speaking of that,
Brian Reigate was talking about his last episode when the Justice Society of America came back in the 90s. That I think he said it was Alan Scott that was doing it, kept using the phrase, not, which seems really strange.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering correctly, that it was Alan Scott, because, you know, he's not.
He's not that way, yeah.
He's not a young guy.
Old fogey, yeah.
Yeah, maybe he was just trying to be hip.
He did de-age, though, for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
They called him Sentinel, right? I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd still have some of the same sensibilities, though, even if he was physically younger, but anyways.
Yeah, and the artist I don't think I mentioned is Bill Merriman.
Hmm.
And this is the time period where Judge Dredd was big at DC, and Zero Hour was getting ready to start. This is right before Zero Hour, and the Elseworld annuals were coming out. So that's just some nice little tidbits.
Context. Cool. So yeah, I said I decided to read some DC this time, and I picked out some issues I had around, I haven't read yet. One being The Brave and the Bold 175. I just pick up random issues of this in DC Comics Presents sometimes when I see them and if they have interesting team-ups. This one is actually a team-up. The guest star with Batman is Lois Lane, actually. And this is a pre-crisis story. Came out in March of 1981. It has a Jim Aparo cover, and he did the art, of course, as he was in the midst of his really long run on the title. And it was written by Paul Kupperberg, who at this point had been writing for DC since around 1977, he pretty much mostly did DC work throughout his career. And this is one of only two Brave and the Bold issues that he wrote. The other one was 163, which was a team-up with Black Lightning. And this story, the villain is Metallo. This is Metallo's first appearance since Superman 331 in 1979, and the premise, the reason that Lois Lane, she's comes to Gotham from Metropolis, she's actually on a story, of course, and she's actually following Metallo. She goes to Bruce Wayne, who she doesn't know is Batman, but she knows has a connection with Batman, and asks him if he could request Batman's help for her because she's following a lead that Metallo had stolen uranium from Star Labs, that he needs it to keep the robot body alive because that's the only energy source he can use that besides kryptonite. And at this point, Batman, at the beginning of the story, had an interaction with Metallo, had just come across him and his patrols, and Metallo uses a kryptonite beam on Batman, which shouldn't affect humans, but somehow it does, and Metallo gets away, and Batman's not really sure what the deal was and why that happened. So obviously Batman very easily gets the message from Bruce Wayne that Lois Lane is looking for him, and he shows up to watch out for her. And as she's going to look for this doctor, this Dr. Crenshaw, that supposedly was working on a project that was related to Metallo, because he was a member of the project that turned him into a cyborg originally. So he's after Crenshaw, try to get him some help, try to get him to help him fix him so that he can deal with this dependency that his body has on chemicals. Eventually Batman's trapped by Metallo. He has to escape and catch up with Metallo and Lois Lane. And there's a sequence where Dr. Crenshaw is working with Metallo, trying to fix his lead shielding because it's starting to radiate and give off leak radiation. And then there's some war machines that metallic war machines, robotic war machines that are after after Batman, kind of delaying his process of getting into the labs. And once he does get in there, and in the midst of a fight with Metallo, once again, Metallo uses his kryptonite beam, and for some reason it's affecting Batman. And Lois Lane, although she's not the typical superhero that Batman teams up with, she does have a moment where Metallo has Batman subdued, and she comes swinging in on a hook and kicks Metallo in the back of his head with her heels. Batwang! Ugh!
And he's got a metal head, so...
Yeah, that's... Like that, so that's
that heel has got to be pretty damn vicious.
Yeah, I don't know if she snapped her... Doesn't show if she snapped the heel off of her shoe, But Crenshaw seems to be not really on the up and up, and he has a panel where he's almost crowded out by his word balloon as he explains a lot of stuff. Basically, he fixed the shielding around Metallo's uranium heart, but he also removed the shielding from his kryptonite beam. And it made the conversion process to send out the kryptonite beam unstable. And as a result, Crenshaw's no longer a threat to him, but he's got a gun trained on Batman because he doesn't want to surrender himself to the law for the stuff that he's done, the ways that he's been culpable. But obviously that's not much to stop Batman. He just kicks the gun out of the guy's hand and locks him up in some handcuffs. So that's the resolution of the story. But it was, you know, a pretty fun story. There's a backup that I didn't read because it was part three of a story. I had no idea what it was connected to.
What was it, though?
By it's Nemesis.
Oh, awesome.
By Carrie Burkett and Dan Spiegel.
Suicide Squad spy stuff.
Oh, is it connected to that?
Well, Nemesis was a huge part of Suicide Squad, yeah.
Okay, it kind of looks like that. I mean, it looks cool, but
there was even a weird series, Final Crisis Nemesis series. It had two arcs. Yeah, he even dated Wonder Woman, I believe, at a time. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I want to read the Checkmate and that kind of stuff someday, but this didn't look like something that would be easy to jump into. So it was
if it was back then, I think you'd be able to figure out what was going on, though.
Mm-hmm.
they did a pretty good job of, he'll have a thought bubble. Last issue, I fell on my head and
where I'm at.
You know, they do a good job of doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for a while, the Brave and the Bolds were only about 17 pages, and then they increased the page count, but they did that by adding the backup, and they kept the main Batman story the same number of pages once they were in a better position to add more pages. But, pretty good story. You know, it was a little bit different to have Lois Lane and Metallo in a Batman story, you know? So that added some appeal.
Metallo. And in the New 52, I think he was attracted to Lois. Like, her father was trying to get them to date.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds vaguely familiar. I haven't read a lot of Superman in general. Mm-hmm. I really haven't read much New 52 Superman at all.
So I'm going to talk about Wonder Woman 178. And this is the beginning of the end, if you will, like where she gets close to the I Ching series and stuff like that. Matter of fact, on the cover it says, Wonder Woman, forget the old, the new Wonder Woman is here. And it kind of has her crossing out her Diana Prince and Wonder Woman outfit and replacing it with a hippie outfit. So this one is from what year? 1968. So it's a little older than me. And the writer is Dennis O'Neill. And I think the artist is Mike Sekowiski. But I'm not sure.
Sack of whiskey?
Sack of whiskey. So this series is this opens up. It's a weird era of Wonder Woman because Wonder Woman is dating Steve Trevor. And the relationship is really weird. Like, they'll be out in their car and they're macking on each other and she's in her Wonder Woman outfit. It's just really weird. It feels like one of those like dating comic books, like secret loves of something or another, but it's bizarre. But anyway, this one opens up with Steve Trevor getting a knock on the door and two detectives are there to arrest him. And they're there to arrest him for the death of a Alex Block. He said he was murdered tonight and we know that you had a fight with him earlier. Where were you at this time? And he says, I was with this hippie girl. And it's like, I have no idea why he was with this hippie girl. Like, there's no reason he should have been. It's just a weird. And then he's on trial. So this is called like the trial of Steve Trevor. He's wanted for murder. And it gives you a flashback where he's at a party with this guy, this Alex guy, who's real rich. And he's like plastered. He's hammered. And he's trying to pick up on Wonder Woman. And he's like, hey, you know something Muscles made? He calls her Muscles made. You ain't human. You're a freak. And he says, but I like you anyway. Come here, baby. Let's have a little bitty drink together. Just you and me. And Steve Trevor says, Alex, you're asking for it. And he punches him in the face and knocks him out. So that was the controversial scene. But it's weird is that they're at this party and Wonder Woman's in her she's dressed up in her costume.
Weird.
And this guy is hitting on her. And so later on that evening, they're
sounds like he's drunk too. Let's have a little drink.
He's talking. Sure. It's the only way I can stand your girlfriend if I'm drunk. So he's like,
Muscle Maid doesn't sound very attractive either. It doesn't sound like a compliment.
Well, he's not very complimentary to her, but he does grab her around the. And it's like Wonder Woman can protect herself, damn it.
Yeah.
She could like flip this guy over. She doesn't need Steve Trevor. But he does put his hand around her breasts, so he's getting real forward. But later that night, they decide to go out in a parking lot at the airport and start making out. And Steve tells her, "I can't help it. I love you. And every time I hear some fink making a crack about you, I see red." And it says later, Wonder Woman went out on a crime-fighting mission and dropped in. And he dropped in at one of those hippie clubs called the Tangerine Trolley. And I don't know why Steve Trevor, in his military outfit, would go into this trippy Tangerine Trolley place. But he meets a girl, and he kind of notices a ring and hangs out with her. And that's like his alibi, but nobody can find her, so she's missing. And then on the day of the trial, they put Wonder Woman on trial. And, you know, she can't tell a lie. And so she has to tell him that he says, "But there is one way Steve could protect you, the way any man would protect the woman he loves." And he said, "Did he hit him?" And he's like, "Yeah, he hit him." "Did he threaten him?" And Wonder Woman says, "Yeah, he did. He did it twice." He threatened him, like wishing he was dead. So she tells the truth, and then he's going to court. Steve's pissed off because Wonder Woman couldn't lie, and he's going to jail, and he's found guilty. So Steve Trevor actually goes to jail, and then she decides to go undercover as Diana Prince. And here's where she changes her costume. She goes to this hippie guy, and she gets like these weird hippie outfits, and like everybody's attracted to her, especially these hippies. She goes to the hippie bar, the Tangerine Trolley, to find this woman, and she events meeting a one old hippie guy that helps her find this area, and they end up killing him because he knows the truth about where that girl is, which is his alibi. And it just gets really trippy after that. But if it turns out that Steve Trevor's, one of his best friends, is trying to frame him for the murder that he committed. In other words, he killed this guy, and he's trying to frame. So what he's trying to do is hide the hippie chick. Well, Diana Prince goes undercover and finds the hippie chick and gets Steve Trevor out of jail. So that's how it ends. And in the next issue, it says, "The new Wonder Woman, how different is she going to be? You saw the great change in Diana Prince. Now watch what happens to Wonder Woman in future issues." But it's really trippy. And then she's like, at the end of it, she's asking for forgiveness from Steve because she pretty much sent him to jail. And then she's like thinking to herself, how could I – Steve doesn't know she's Diana Prince. Mm-hmm. And it looks like he's like really falling in love with Diana Prince now that she got him off of the – out of jail. She says, like, now I'm jealous of myself? How can I be jealous of myself? That is a great issue. I loved it.
Nice. It's so interesting to hear
so
how
weird,
it led in.
Though. She's so – weird, like she's got superpowers and there's no reason why she should need Steve Trevor to protect her. She should have just kicked this guy's ass.
No, it's almost like they're writing it in such a way that she's letting him stand up for her.
Yeah, that's the way it read. Yeah.
Well, my other DC one was the other team up title, Superman's DC Comics Presents. And this is very close to the end of the comic. It run issue 94, and the last issue was 97. So this is at the point where DC Comics Presents is written super, super small, and then Superman is really big. And this is actually, I picked this up because it was Superman and Harbinger, Lady Quark, and Pariah.
Crisis tie-in.
Yeah, but it actually doesn't have a Crisis tie-in banner. It actually came out after
crisis was over, but it pretty much seems like a pre-crisis story. So it's almost like it takes place in the time in between, like in between the end of Crisis issue 12 and the true beginning of the new Earth. It came out in March of 1986, and it was written by Barbara Kessel, who was going by Barbara Randall at the time, and she'd only written a couple things before this, and so maybe that's why Bob Greenberger is credited as writer as well, and he's pretty much, you know, known as an editor at DC. He didn't actually do a lot of writing, but he's known as really well known as an editor. Art was by Tom Mandrake, who was early-ish in his career, and he did the pencils, and then the inks were by Don Heck, who at this point had been around for a while, actually.
Huge fan of Mandrake's.
50s. I thought so, yeah.
Spectre and Firestorm is especially...
Right, yeah. Firestorm he did later on in the run, right?
Yeah. I like his style a lot. His Spectre was awesome.
Isn't his style a little bit more...
darker line. It's a real dark style.
Yeah.
He did the Elemental Firestorm.
Right.
When Ostrander was doing it.
Ostrander, yeah.
Yeah.
His
Ostrander he did the Spectre with, too. So they must have some kind of good working repertoire with each other.
Yeah, from what I recall of what Mandrake usually looks like, maybe because this is a issue of DC Comics Presents, it's you can see his style in some of the faces sometimes are heavily shadowed, but maybe because of the Don Heck inks or just because of it's a Superman story, it looks a little bit different than the darker titles that his style might be a little more suited towards. But yeah, so it's interesting. It starts out in Star Labs. There's a fellow, it's called The Challenge of the Vault Lord, and it starts off with the Vault Lord. He's this kind of funny looking villain. He's got a gold tunic, or like a gold vest over a green tunic, and a purple cape, and a purple hood with this really huge visor on it. And he blasts off kind of, it looks kind of like Cannonball does from the New Mutants when he's flying, where the lower half of his body is just in a sort of a streak. But he steals some stuff from Star Labs, and Superman comes up as he's starting to get away. And they blast Superman with a bolt of what seems like electricity. And Superman's momentarily done in, so Vault Lord gets away. And it's funny because, well, one of the things that makes this seem like it's still Earth One pre-crisis is that Clark Kent, his situation, he still works for Galaxy Broadcasting System and does a television show. So it's really not like the John Byrne Man of Steel kind of Superman yet. And he has to go because he's on schedule to be at work. So he changes back into Clark Kent, and he's got a interview actually with the trio of Crisis characters, Pariah, Lady Quark, and Harbinger. And the very first guest on this new show, Spotlight on People. And so Clark Kent's interviewing them as they're traveling the country doing research and asking them, you know, what brings them to Metropolis. And Harbinger says, we're studying phenomena and persons that are paranormal, and their interest in Metropolis because it seems that it's attracting heroes in addition to Superman. There's also Blue Devil and recently addition of Booster Gold. So they're curious what makes Metropolis a place that would have several different heroes there. After the interview, Lady Quark ends up talking to the producer of the show, this guy named Mr. Courtney, and he kind of hits on Lady Quark, and they end up taking off and going on a date, the two of them. So Superman takes, well, rather Clark Kent takes Harbinger and Pariah out for dinner. But it's kind of funny because it's just a rare occasion where you see Pariah and Harbinger out of costume. Pariah still, he's wearing a suit, but he still has the heavy, dark lines under his eyes. But Harbinger, you very rarely see her without that red headgear. And she's just wearing a red dress, and she has her hair done and everything, so she just looks like a really pretty blonde woman. I don't know if there's any other occasions where these characters are seen outside of their costumes, but it's pretty interesting. So later on, while they're out on the town, Lady Quark's back with them, and Volt Lord attacks, and so they assist Superman in going up against Volt Lord, and Lady Quark is struck by similarities of Volt Lord's powers to her, to Carrick, her deceased husband from her Earth. So they have a few more interactions where they're back at staying at an apartment while they're in town, and Lady Quark has another, takes this Mr. Courtney up on another date, and she, it seems like they're getting along pretty well. Superman heats up some room service for Harbinger and Pariah because their breakfast was late. So eventually it turns out that Volt Lord is actually this Mr. Courtney that Lady Quark has been seeing. And he wants her to rule it aside. He tries to tempt her, and it looks at first like she's giving in, even though, you know, she's asking him, you know, stop with the violence. And he tells her, you know, it's necessary, and blasts Superman and goes flying. Harbinger and Lady Quark shoot at each other, and Harbinger goes flying into Superman's hands. But then Lady Quark has a vision again of her husband and her daughter, Liana. And she says, I must have been a fool to think I could really change my allegiances so easily. And she blasts Lord Volt. And the ending is kind of melancholy, where she apologizes to the other heroes, says that Courtney Eric Courtney confused her feelings, because it was that he reminded her of Carrick, her husband, so much. She says in the end that they may start calling her Tashana, her real name, instead of Lady Quark, because that's a name that's associated with another time, and she's only going to use it and reserved for battle. So what I find kind of interesting about this is that you have these characters that were sort of created for the crisis event, and to varying degrees they attempted to continue to use them in DC Comics. I mean, Harbinger would pop up here and there, and for a stretch of time, you know, she was involved in Millennium and the first Guardians of the Universe kind of title and stuff that spun out of that and stuff. But the character's never really shaken their association with Crisis. Pariah and Lady Quark. I think Lady Quark, wasn't she in that Legion acronym series.
Legion Rebel?
Yeah, like Rebel and
Legion 98, 92, and 93, and 94. Yeah.
Those ones and stuff. But so for a little while they used the characters, but I think they had a difficulty making them anything more than characters people associated with Crisis. And
Harbinger was on Paradise Island for a long time.
Yeah.
She was like their archivist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she kind of continued. They do make a mention of monitor tapes in the in the issue, how even though she's not working for the monitor in the same way as in Crisis, she still wants to catalog and create a database and stuff. But I am kind of reminded of what DC had with Pandora, where they sort of threw her in to all the new 52 number ones as this mysterious character. And I think that they were kind of making it up as they went along and tried to make the character again mean more than something just associated with an event and stuff, but didn't seem to, they weren't really successful in getting her to catch on with fans, I don't think.
She was interesting, though. Her comic was really good.
Yeah.
Because she was like in the Trinity of Sin, and she was with Phantom Stranger and Question, and they were all trying to redeem themselves from the sin that caused all of this shit to happen. At least they were believed to.
Yeah.
But,
and I didn't read a lot of that stuff. I know that you enjoyed it, and I know that DC really tried to get that to catch on and stuff. It just, I think especially with Pandora, I mean, obviously they'll do more with Question and Spectre, and those characters have a legacy outside of...
She was kind of like that Pyra thing, that guy.
Pariah,
who would go cry everywhere, except she would do stuff about it.
Yeah.
That Pariah would just go show up at places and whine and cry.
And like Pariah, I don't think...
A pacifist.
I don't think Pandora is ever really going to be a major popular character for DC Comics. Not that everyone has to be, but it just kind of reminds me of these Crisis characters. Yeah. Whereas Question and Spectre and Phantom Stranger, you know, those are proven characters that maybe are not A-list, but I think they'll always have a life of some fashion at DC. I think they've proven to be interesting enough that they can bring them around for a series once in a while, but I don't think Pandora is really on the same level as them. Just reminds me of it, you know, Pariah and Lady Quirk.
Yeah.
You know, so.
A D-lister.
Kinda, yeah. And you need D-listers,
there's not a huge difference there. Pandora had her own title, and none of those people ever did.
That's true. She did have one for a little while. Didn't last, and I don't think anyone expected it to, but...
A defender of...
They tried.
Pandora.
Yeah. And it's not I'm not making a value judgment on whether the character's interesting or not, it's just... But...
I know what you're making. You're making a point that...
Talking about it from a business side.
That side, yeah.
Yeah.
Mystical characters are a hard sell as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Name one that's lasted long. I mean, Doctor Strange has had a long series, but like Spectre and Doctor Fate, they don't have long-running series. New ones coming out, though.
No, and I would argue Doctor Strange, now it's been a long time since he's really sustained an ongoing. I mean, the movie may change that, but...
When Spirits of Vengeance and stuff were coming out, he had a long run there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his solo title, once he left Strange Tales, lasted quite a long time.
Yeah, Mystic stuff did do better back then, too, it seems like.
Yeah, the Mystical Monsters, hard sells now, I guess.
He's the sort of character that has had some good runs. He's just not on the level of where there's always going to be a Doctor Strange series going. You know, they'll have one and it might last for a while, and then they'll take a break and then they'll bring them back, and like maybe B-list where you have certain characters, obviously Batman, Spider-Man and stuff. There's always going to be at least one, if not several, comics with them, you know.
Right.
But Dr. Strammy, he's pretty close to, as far as a Mystic character goes, he's probably, might be the best example of the most prominent one.
Mm-hmm. Most recognizable one.
Yeah,
non-fandom,
mm-hmm.
I think. But he did have his own TV show or pilot in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, Strange. Probably right now a lot of non-fans don't know who he is, but I think that'll change, though.
The movie comes out.
Yeah, that'll change. Because, I mean, even Iron Man, before the first Iron Man movie, really wasn't as recognizable. Now everybody knows who he freaking is.
More so than, he's more recognizable than Doctor Strange ever was, or Ant-Man for that matter. But yeah, after the movie Ant-Man comes out, everybody will recognize him now.
Mm-hmm.
So the preview looks really good. I saw it. I saw Avengers yesterday. It was really good.
Yeah, I saw you saw that. I haven't seen it. Yeah. I didn't go.
So my last book is Blue Beetle, another DC comic, number 3. From I don't know what year this is from, but it's in the 1986, post-Crisis, on Infinite Earths, because I think Crisis is where they brought them all in, the Charlton characters, and yeah. Coming out of it, you got Question, Captain Atom series, and Blue Beetle, and Nightshade started to show up in the Suicide Squad. So a lot of the characters, Sarge Steele even, I think, was in pieces of the Suicide Squad in Checkmate. So they took a lot of the... Peter Cannon had his series at DC called Thunderbolt. So a lot of the Charlton characters got a little bit of love. And Captain Atom was the longest running one, title that they had. The Question was probably the most... critically acclaimed by Denny O'Neill, mm-hmm. and Blue Beetle was a loved title. A lot of people loved the Blue Beetle. Yeah. A lot of the Blue Beetle fans, though, came out of the Justice League International. They didn't read mm-hmm. this Paris Collins and Len Wein miniseries. Actually, it was a full Gaunt series. But this is an amazing series. I'd highly, highly, highly recommend it to any Blue Beetle fans. And the last time I covered this, there was all kinds of chaos going with a bunch of villains. And this one opens up where one of the scientists, Jeremiah Duncan, he's the guy that is a scientist with Melody, who's Ted Kord's love interest in the title, who both work for him as scientists, is going to his car, and he's met by a bunch of dudes that are there to kick his ass, and they start to beat the crap out of him, and we don't know why they're there to kick his ass. He owes them something. One of the guys has a very distinctively beatnik type goatee, if you will. On the cover of this, I might mention that this is the Blue Beetle mixes up with the Mad Men. I think they were also Charlton villains that are coming back in this title. And it looks like they're about to beat Jeremiah down when Blue Beetle shows up and he breaks up this madness. Paris Collins draws Blue Beetle really good and really dynamically, so it almost looks like he's always in motion. He does use his light gun to blind them and then start knocking them out. And eventually saves Jeremiah, but when the fight is over, Jeremiah's missing. And he knows that something's going on with Jeremiah, and he has to find out, but he doesn't want to give his identity away. And then it cuts to the secretary, Angela Revere,
Angelina Jolie,
who is his secretary or his clerical type worker at Ted Kord Industries, who's been stealing equipment from Ted Kord. And we find out who she's giving the equipment to, but you never see the guy's face. It's her uncle. And you just see his arms, and he's building something, and you don't know what he's building, but she's stealing all kinds of equipment. She feels horribly bad. She loves her boss, but her uncle's very abusive. He starts to beat her when she says, "I can't steal from my boss anymore." And he's like, "Oh, the hell you will. I'm going to make the world pay." And he starts abusing her. He grabs her by her hands and really hurts her. So she's going to go steal some more stuff. So he's got a lot of workers that are in these weird situations. He ends up going in his bug back underneath he's got this cool thing in the Lake Michigan, where he takes the bug in and comes back out as Ted Kord. And then he's working with that Star Labs guy to work on that Prometheum stuff. And him and his scientists are working on trying to stabilize that Prometheum, which is something that a villain was in and previously trying to get a hold of. And that villain shows up in a bar, and he was trying to recruit one of the guys that Blue Beetle beat up. And he says, "I need you to bring back the madmen, and here's what I need you to do. I need you to attack Kord Industries." So he sends them after Kord Industries. Ted has a run-in with Melody when he's trying to find Jeremiah. He confronts Jeremiah and tries to figure out why he was getting beat up, but Jeremiah doesn't give him any information. Then you have some blue-collar workers at Kord Industries that are in shipping and receiving, and they receive a bunch of strange boxes. And they say, none of this stuff's on the manifest, and they're talking about retiring and stuff, and they hate their jobs. All we do is unpack boxes and then pack boxes and load them up. They're very upset about what they're doing in life. Like, nothing matters. So they just take these boxes, even though they're not on the manifest, and load them up on the pier. Well, those boxes contain the madmen, all the guys that essentially beat up Jeremiah are the madmen. They're just coming in. Meanwhile, the detective that's investigating the murder of Dan Garrett decides to show up. And the secretary thinks she's going to get arrested for stealing equipment, but no, he's there for Ted Kord, and he wants to know what happened to Dan Garrett on the island. And he wants to frame him, and then the alarms go off, and that's when the madmen break in and start busting up the place. And the detective goes after the madman. Ted Kord dresses up as Blue Beetle and starts fighting the madman. But what they're really after is to cause chaos so Dr. Alchemy could get into there and get the Promethean. And supposedly nice. He's become like godlike. And he goes, he actually got the Prometheum, and he's like, "Now my name is Dr. Alchemy, and at this moment I am the rightful ruler of the world." And that's when Ted Kord walks in, and the issue is going to be continued in number 4. So they do a really good job of characterization in these 3 issues. You start to care about these characters and what they're – the side characters. And Ted Kord is a really cool guy. He's like Peter Parker in the current situation where he has his company, right?
Yeah.
That's what like Ted Kord was like back then. And, man, it was a really good a really good comic. I am really enjoying these Blue Beetles. Like they stand out. Like I almost want to just read the whole damn thing, but I'm gonna save it probably for next week because I got to read current stuff or I'll fall extremely far behind.
I have that whole run. I need to read it too.
It's amazing. I just love it.
Yeah, I like the character a lot, and I love the Blue Beetle legacy stuff with Dan Garrett, and then
and the other part that they didn't address in this issue is you still have that archaeologist that's out there on the island, on Pogo Island, trying to uncover the secrets of the island, and he looks very mischievous.
Mm.
Like, once he finds stuff, I'm sure he's going to become a villain of Blue Beetle. But he's very witty. Mm-hmm. He's a lot like Peter Parker when he fights with
yeah.
the lens cracks and stuff. And like one time he was fighting the madman. There's one scene where he's getting the weird. They must have their faces just painted, I imagine, because the one beatnik guy that was beating up Jeremiah is the lead madman, and he's got this distinctive goatee hanging from his chin. And
goatee,
yeah. he's got it hanging from his chin, and Blue Beetle points the gun at him, and he's like, "I fell for it the first time with your light gun." So he puts the hands over his eyes, like to protect himself, and then he uses the air compressor part of the gun and just slams him into the wall. It's like, "Whoom!" And he's like, goes against the wall. And he's like indented into the wall like something you'd see in Looney Tunes, you know? He just knocked the shit out of him. It was a fun issue. Paris Collins is so good at drawing movement. Like, you'll see him flipping, and he draws, like, there'll be one panel where you see, like, 12 flips in action, you know?
Mm-hmm.
With the most current character in the foreground, and all the other movements in the background with shading in the colors and stuff, so you know he's moved. You know, it's awesome.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I almost think Blue Beetle is almost kind of a combination of Batman and Spider-Man in some ways, because he doesn't have the powers, but he uses his technology. You know.
Yeah, that's where he's like Batman.
Right.
But he's got the humor and stuff of Spider-Man.
Right. Yeah. Well, only thing I have left is I have my Star Trek report for this time.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't watch as many between this and last episode as I did between the last two, but I did watch 7 more episodes of season 2, starting with episode 6 of season 2, which was The Doomsday Machine. And all these episodes were decent that I watched. This one was about the Enterprise finding their sister ship, the Constellation, adrift in space. And Kirk, Scott, and McCoy beam over, and they find the Commodore of the ship, Matt Decker, and he's the only one left alive, and he's totally freaked out. So McCoy takes him back to the Enterprise while Kirk and Scott stay on the Constellation, try to figure out what's going on, and turns out that they were attacked by a doomsday machine, hence the title, which were these large ships that were created like kind of like the nuclear weapons, the H-bomb and whatnot, where they were mostly used for threat and intimidation, and the doomsday machine wasn't actually deployed in war, but this one attacked the Constellation. And so Decker ends up on the ship and ends up taking over the Enterprise and is fighting with their orders, he has a lot of conflicts with Spock. He wants to attack the Doomsday Machine and destroy it, and ultimately there's a lot of tension at the end where they figure out that they can beam Kirk and Scott back at the very last second and send the Constellation ship into the Doomsday Machine to destroy it. And, I mean, even though you know Kirk and Scott are going to survive, they did a good job of making it really tense and at the last minute and stuff with the countdown and all that. The next episode was Cat's Paw. This was probably the only one that was a little too silly for me. It aired a few days before Halloween in '67.
and they go to this planet where these two beings, they access humans' memory to, and they think that they're creating what will be familiar to the crew, but it's all like Halloweenish, and there's a black cat and all this stuff, and it basically turns out these two alien beings from another planet, and they're using this transmitter device to make themselves appear human, and it's just one of those episodes that they end up on a planet that seems old-fashioned or whatever, but it was kind of a weird fit for it to be a Halloween episode on Star Trek. But I think the rest of the episodes were all decent that I watched. I, Mud, which is a kind of a sequel to a first season episode called Mud's Women, and it has the same character, Harcourt Fenton Mud, who's a really funny guy, kind of a comic character, but he's come to this planet and he's ruling over all these androids, and they have different, like there's Alice 1 through 500 and it's played by these two twins. But they're supposed to be 500 of them. So they keep like changing the numbers that are hanging around their necks and stuff to make it seem like they're different versions of the same model. And there's this kind of neat, fun sequence where the cast does all these pantomime situations where they pretend to be doing something in order to overload the circuits of the androids on the planet. They end up going crazy because they're trying to process it and they don't understand the idea of play acting and pretending. So they get confused by that, and it's fun to see the cast do these goofy things. It's goofy and silly in kind of a fun way, whereas Cat's Paw is kind of goofy in a way that doesn't really hold up. Episode 9 was an interesting episode called Metamorphosis, where they meet the creator of the warp drive technology, Zefram Cochrane, who ends up appearing in later Star Trek stuff, I guess. They're transporting this commissioner named Nancy Hedford on the Galileo, the shuttle, trying to get her back to the Enterprise, and she has this disease called Sakuro's disease, and she's deteriorating. She needs medical help. But they get zapped down to this planet by this red light, and they find Cochrane, and when they find out he's Zefram Cochrane, they're incredulous because he should be dead, and they find out he's been living there for like 100 years, that he was old when he went on his last mission, but there's this force on the planet that he calls the Companion, and it made him young again. And well, eventually it turns out that this being, the Companion, is in love with him and ends up really kind of weird ending where it merges with this Commissioner Hedford, heals her disease, and it's this kind of like combination of Hedford and the Companion, and decides to live there with Cochrane together as like a couple, because she's in love with him. Then we had Journey to Babel, where you get to meet Spock's parents for the first time. You remember we talked about the Buck Rogers episode where the actor that plays Sarek played the guy. I think he was the guy that took off his head, right?
Yeah, he was the guy that removed his heads.
Yeah, so
the one that was sexually attracted to Wilma, or they had a relationship in the past.
Right, yeah. So that actually obviously comes after this, but
he's in the movies too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think he plays Sarek quite a bit, right? And his mom's in it, his mom Amanda. And it was really interesting seeing their interactions with Spock. You know, she's human and he's Vulcan. And this also introduces you to the Andorians and the Tellarites. The Andorians they're blue-skinned with the antennae, and the Tellarites look like pigs. But there's a fake Andorian. It's not actually really an Andorian, and one of his antennae is a transmitter, and he's behind this thing where they think Sarek has killed one of the Tellarites. It looks like he's done this Tal Shaya, this Vulcan form of assassination, but it turns out to be this fake Andorian, and It was kind of, I especially liked the, because I'm getting into Spock and the Vulcans and stuff a lot, so I liked seeing his parents. Two more real quick. Friday's Child. This takes place on a planet called Capella 4, where there's this race of beings called the Capellans. And this one had Julie Newmar as a guest star.
Ooh.
Yeah. she plays a Capellan. She plays the wife of a leader of the Capellans called Akkar. And Akkar is, the Klingons are there as well. And so the Klingons and the Enterprise are both trying to create a relationship with these Capellans. And at first, it doesn't look very good for the Enterprise, or, well, the Federation, obviously, because there's, like, some misunderstanding with them surrendering their weapons. And Akkar is deposed by this other Capellan named Mab. So the crew of the Enterprise, they help Aline, which is Julie Newmar. She's pregnant. They help her escape. And there's this really funny moment where you're not supposed to touch royalty. And McCoy, he's trying to do his doctorly duty to her as a pregnant woman. So he keeps trying to touch her, and she keeps pushing him away. And he really wants to examine the baby and make sure it's okay. And she slaps him twice in a row when he tries to touch her, and so he slaps her across the face. And after that, she decides that she'll only let McCoy touch her. And when she's giving birth, there's this confusion where she thinks that he's taking responsibility for the child, and thinks that he's going to be act as the child's father. There's just some funny moments, but ultimately they save her, and they ends up being a situation where she's able to go back to her people, but she names her baby Leonard James Akkar. And McCoy and Kirk are real pleased with themselves, much to Spock's chagrin that she named the baby after the two of them. But actually, I guess this Leonard James Akkar has appeared in, I don't think he's ever appeared in a show, but he's appeared in, like, the novels and the extended universe and stuff, and he goes on to be to the Academy and stuff. So that's interesting. And then finally I watched The Deadly Years, which is where the strange radiation turns them all into old people, and they have to do this hearing to pronounce Kirk not fit for command, because he keeps forgetting things and mixing stuff up, and he doesn't want to relinquish command. There's this Commodore on the ship named Stocker that, you know, he has good intentions and stuff, but he has no battle experience. So he ends up in command for a little while, and they make a decision. He tells Sulu to plot a course across the neutral zone so they can get to a place to treat this sickness, and that decision results in them getting fired upon by the Romulans, and he just really doesn't know what to do. And they're getting fired on by the Romulans, and fortunately Kirk ends up getting healed in time to go and save the day. But it's funny, the makeup on the actors and stuff, and now that they actually, you know, one thing, now that we know what William Shatner looks like as an old man, it's interesting that making him look old in this episode, they just put makeup on his face, you know, but his body is still the same size. Whereas we've seen that William Shatner has put on quite a few pounds.
Yeah.
Well, this disease, this radiation, apparently doesn't make you gain weight. It just makes you old in the same body. But yeah, besides Cat's Paw, all pretty entertaining shows, and I'm definitely into Star Trek like I never have been before, so it's interesting.
It sounds like you're going through the episodes pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch this last time. I think I only talked about half of what I watched, because I had watched like 14 or something. But I watched, in the last 2 weeks, I watched 7 this time, but I'm making progress. I mean, there's a lot of episodes left in this season. I got season 3. And then, well, obviously I could be watching Star Trek for a super long time if I want to. We'll see how long I go with it. But with all the other shows, and we'll see far I go. But
not too much farther, though, with the regular series, right?
Well, there's another
season.
Yeah, there's another season. This season, I've watched 12 episodes, and there's another, like, 14 or 16 or something. They're pretty long seasons, so I don't know if anyone out there wants to share an opinion of whether I should watch the animated series or just go on to the motion picture after I finish Star Trek. I'd be interested in opinions. I've heard the animated
series. I'd say go for the animated series.
Have you? I've heard it's kind of for kids, but
I don't know. It's in order.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. Well, that's Mike's vote. If anyone else has a vote, let me know. But yeah, it's really well written. I mean, a lot of the episodes are really, really well written. That episode with Julie Newmar, I mean, I tried to streamline it as much as I could, but it's very, like, very complicated plot, but not in, like, you can't follow it, but there's a lot going on. And that, and I think it was Journey to Babel, were both written by DC Fontana. She's a really good writer. She's the one that started out as the creator's secretary, and then went on to become a writer, and it's a really, really good writer.
Mm-hmm.
Really good episodes that she wrote.
Cool beans.
Yep. So that's all I got.
All right. That's all I have. And you can reach us on the Facebooks at Geek Brunch Podcast. And click the like button and follow the episodes there. At Mythmaking ETC on the Twitters. Mm-hmm. At Mike Myers Brunch. And our site is www.geekbrunchpodcast.com. And we have emails, mythmakingetc@gmail.com and mike@comicbooknoise.com. Thank you, Brian, for sending us some questions to talk about and some things to think about. And we encourage every listener to do that. What else? Am I missing anything? I think I got everything.
I think so.
Yeah, so, and check out your other podcasts.
Yes, tomorrow, by the time this is released, will be Kid Flash episode 16.
Until tomorrow!
Until tomorrow. Until from Kid to Flash 16. But that's, I'm talking about Teen Titans 18, 19, and 20. And issue 20 is interesting because that's, it was originally written by Marv Wolfman and Len Wein, and then they scrapped the issue with only a week left in the deadline because they were trying to introduce the first DC black superhero. He would have been called Jericho, a name that Wolfman ended up using for a different character later on. But the original Jericho was black, and then they scrapped at the last minute, and Neil Adams came up with a different story using the same title because the cover was already done.
Why did they scrap it?
Well, it's not real clear. Everyone says different things. I mean,
what did Marv Wolfman say? That's the truth.
He said that he doesn't know if there's any truth to them. Like, because Len Wein has said that Carmine Infantino got cold feet and was afraid that the book wouldn't sell in the South because it had black characters. And the story dealt with this Jericho character. It turns out that in the original story that his brother is in this gang of black kids that are being manipulated by criminals into criminal activity. And Jericho wants to enlist the Titans' help in stopping these kids because they were, you know, good kids before the criminals started manipulating him, and Jericho's brother is one of them. So Len Wein has said that he thinks Carmine Infantino got cold feet because the characters are black, and Carmine Infantino says it just was a crappy story, basically. And he didn't like it, and he didn't want to publish it. But the interesting thing is when they changed the story, maybe this was just Neil Adams' choice, but all the characters that were black originally are now white. So it's just, if it was just a bad story, why did they do that, you know?
Yeah.
But
that's why I'd rather go to the writer's perspective, because
yeah,
the editors are in all fairness, they are trying to sell what they want to, you know, they want to sell copies. They don't care how they do it.
Right, right.
It's all about the money.
Yeah, yeah. So, especially the higher up. I mean, he was editorial director at the time, and Fantino was. Where someone like Dick Giordano, who was editor of the book, he okayed the idea, just kind of, they might have a little bit less concerned with, like, I mean, they're concerned with sales, but, like, especially when you started having people like Giordano and whatnot that were comic book creators first and became editors, you know, they might have a little more.
He worked a lot with Charlton.
Yeah, that's where he came from when they
hired him. He worked for
two
guys that came out of prison.
Right.
He says, I'm going to go work for these guys.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people that were either in prison or should have been in prison that were involved in comics early days.
Yeah, I think he moved over and took Aparo with him. That's what happened.
Pretty much, yeah. He right around the same time that he took over Teen Titans, he took over Aquaman.
Yeah.
And he immediately replaced Bob Haney and Nick Carty with Steve Skeets and Jim Aparo.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them were really young. I mean, Len Wein and Marv Wolf, and these guys were like younger than you would probably get a chance nowadays at DC.
Yeah. They were really young when they were at Charlton.
So yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's where you want to really if you want really, like, I want to buy the first appearance of Prankster, which is an Aparo work,
mm-hmm.
Inside of a Charlton,
mm-hmm.
a backup story. So, matter of fact, I'm making a back order purchase today. I think I'm going to look for that one.
Yeah, Wein and Wolfman, they didn't do much they didn't do anything for Charlton, but they, Wolfman had done an internship and stuff at DC, and they lived in New York City, so they were always hanging around. And before they had their story scrapped on issue 20, they had actually written issue 18 of Teen Titans, and that story got published. And it's decent. And I think one of the things that Wolfman does say about issue 20 is that they were trying to. It was right after the civil rights movement and everything, and it hadn't even been a year since Martin Luther King Jr. had gotten shot. So they were just young guys, inexperienced writers that were trying to write about a really weighty topic, and they didn't really have like the writing chops yet to handle it. And he said, like, looking back, the writing's not that great. And it is like heavy handed, you know, characters talk in a way that they probably wouldn't. It's not very realistic. You know, they talk in like declarative sentences, you know?
Yeah.
And that's definitely true of it, because you can see, I'll have a link in the show notes of the podcast, the episode that where you can see a few of the original pages that Nick Carty did. They have it on titanstower.com. Like 9 pages from the original, but it's interesting. But yeah, when they had their first story published, issue 18, they both done a couple issues of stuff for DC. Len Wein was only 20 years old and Marv Wolfman was only 22, so they're really young.
Both fantastic writers.
Yes, both went on to very important careers.
Yes.
But they were just youngins at the time. So they were like the first ones that grew up. You know, they were the first generation of creators that had grown up as comic book fans, you know?
Yeah.
Well,
alrighty. Until next time. We'll cover another Buck Rogers episode. Until next time, when we do some more Star Trek TV episodes. Until next time, when we get some more retro comics. Class is dismissed.
I figured I'd let you do it. Dun, dun, dun.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Have a good Sunday.
You too. Bye-bye. Right,
bye.
This commercial is based on a true story.
Hello? Tracy. No, we don't need a babysitter tonight. Thanks anyway.
After a family bought an Atari video game, they had no trouble getting babysitters.
Oh, my God.
Hello? Kate. No, we don't need a babysitter tonight. Bye.
Everybody enjoys Atari because Atari has so many different games to enjoy.
Hello? Karen. No, we don't need a babysitter tonight.
No other company offers you as many different video game cartridges as Atari.